thin crust on top. The crust was just hard enough for birds to walk on, mice. In the trail, he saw where the cows had come down. The traps in the mountains lay all undisturbed beneath the snow, with their jaws agape like steel trolls, silent and mindless and blind. He took up three of the sets, holding the cocked traps in his gloved hands and reaching under the jaw and tripping the pan with his thumb. The traps leapt mightily. The iron clang of the jaws slamming shut echoed in the cold. You could see nothing of their movement. Now the jaws were open, now they were closed. He rode with the traps packed under the calf hide in the floor of the pack basket, where they would not fall out as he rolled sideways in the saddle to duck low branches. When he came to the fork in the trail, he followed the track she'd taken the evening before, going west toward Hog Canyon. He made the sets in the trail and cut and placed stepping sticks and returned along a route of his own devising a mile to the south and continued down to the Cloverdale Road to visit the last two sets on the line. There was still snow in the upper stretches of the road, and there were tire tracks in the road and horse tracks and the tracks of deer. When he reached the spring, he left the road and crossed through the pasture and dismounted and watered his horse. It was near noon by the sun, and he intended to ride the 4 miles into Cloverdale and go back by way of the road. While the horse was drinking, an old man in a Model A pickup truck pulled up out at the fence. Billy pulled the horse's head up and mounted and went back out to the road and sat the horse alongside the truck. The man leaned out the window and looked up at him. He looked at the pack basket. "What are you trapping?" he said. He was a rancher from the lower valley along the border, and Billy knew him but didn't say his name. He knew the old man wanted to hear that he was trapping coyotes, and he wouldn't lie, or wouldn't exactly lie. "Well," he said, "I seen a lot of coyote sign down here." "I ain't surprised," the old man said. "They done everything down at our place but come in and set at the table." He scanned the country with his pale eyes, as if the little jackal wolves might be afoot on the plain in broadest day. He took out a pack of ready-made cigarettes and shucked one up and took it in his mouth and held up the pack. "Smoke?" "No, sir, thank you." He put the pack away and took from his pocket a brass lighter that looked like something for soldering pipe, burning off paint. He struck it, and a bluish ball of flame whooshed up. He lit the cigarette and snapped the lighter shut, but it continued to burn anyway. He blew it out and dandled it in one hand to cool it. He looked at the boy. "I had to quit using the high test," he said.
"Yes, sir."
"You married?"
"No, sir, I ain't but 16.
"Don't get married. Women are crazy."
"Yes, sir."
"You'll think you found one that ain't, but guess what?"
"What?"
"She will be too."
"Yes, sir."
"You got any big traps in there?"
"Like how big?"
"Number 4, say."
"No, sir. Truth to tell, I don't have none with me of no kind."
"What did you ask me how big for, then?"
"Sir?"
The old man nodded at the road. "There was a mountain lion crossed about a mile down here yesterday evening."
"They're around," the boy said.
"My nephew's got some dogs. Got some blue ticks out of the Lee Brothers line. Pretty good dogs. You don't want them walking in no steel traps, though."
"I'm back up here towards Hog Canyon," the boy said, "and up towards Black Point."
The old man smoked. The horse turned its head and sniffed at the truck and looked away again. "You hear about the Texas line and the New Mexico line?" the old man said.
"No, sir, I don't believe so."
"There was this Texas line and this New Mexico line. They split up on the divide and went off to hunt. Agreed to meet up in the spring and see how they'd done and all, and whenever they'd done it, why, the old line been over in Texas looked just awful. Line from New Mexico, he looked at him and he said, 'Lord, son, you look awful.' Said, 'What's happened to you?' Line been over in Texas said, 'I don't know.' Said, 'I'm about starved out.' Other old line said, 'Well,' said, 'tell me what all you been doing.' Said, 'You might be doing something wrong.' 'Well,' the Texas line said, 'I just been using the old tried and true methods.' Said, 'I get up on a limb overlooking the trail, and then whenever one of the Texans rides underneath it, why, I holler real big, and then I jump out on top of him. And that's what I've been a-doing.' Well, the old New Mexico line looked at him, and he said, 'It's a wonder you ain't dead.'
Said, that's all wrong for you Texans, and I don't see how you got through the winter at all. Said, look here. First of all, when you holler that away, it scares the shit out of them. Then when you jump on top of them that away, it knocks the wind out of them. Hell, son, you ain't got nothing left but buckles and boots. The old man fell across the steering wheel, wheezing. After a while, he began to cough. He looked up and wiped his watery eyes with one finger and shook his head and looked up at the boy. You see the pond? He said. Texans? Billy smiled. Yes, sir, he said. You ain't from Texas, are you? No, sir. I didn't allow you was. Well, I better get on. You want to catch coyotes, you come down to my place. All right. He didn't say where his place was. He put the truck in gear and pulled the spark lever down and pulled away down the road. When they ran the traps on Monday, the snow had melted off everywhere save in the north-facing rincones or in the deeper woods below the north slope of the pass. She'd pulled out all the sets save for the ones in the Hog Canyon Trail, and she had taken to turning the traps over and springing them. They took the traps up, and his father made two new sets with double traps, burying one trap under the other and the bottom trap upside down. Then he made blind sets in the perimeter about. He laid these two new sets, and they returned home, and when they ran the traps the next morning, there was a coyote dead in the first set. They pulled this set entirely, and Billy tied the coyote on behind the cantle of his saddle, and they went on. The coyote's bladder leaked down the horse's flank, and it smelled peculiar. What did the coyote die of? He said. I don't know, said his father. Sometimes things just die. The second set was dug out, and all five traps sprung. His father sat looking at it for a long time. There was no word from Eccles. He and Boyd rode the outlying pastures and began bringing the cattle in. They found two more calves dead, then another heifer. Don't say nothing about this lest he asks, Billy said. Why not? They sat their horses side by side, Boyd sitting Billy's old saddle and Billy in the Mexican saddle his father had traded for. They studied the carnage in the woods. I wouldn't have thought about her pulling down a heifer that big, Billy said. Why not say nothing, said Boyd. What would be the use in worrying him over it? They turned to go. He might want to know about it anyways, Boyd said. When's the last time you heard bad news you were glad to get? What if he finds it himself? Then he'll find it. What are you going to tell him then, that you didn't want to worry him? Damn, you're worse than Mama. I'm sorry I raised the question. He was left to run the traps on his own. He rode up to the SK bar and got the key from Mr. Sanders and went to Eccles' cabin and studied the shelves in the little mudroom pharmacy. He found some more bottles in a crate in the floor. Dusty bottles with grease-stained labels that said lion, that said cat. There were other bottles with curled and yellowed labels that bore only numbers, and there were bottles made of purple glass, dark near to blackness, that had no label at all. He put some of the nameless bottles in his pocket and went back to the front room of the cabin and looked through Eccles' little packing crate library. He took down a book called Trapping North American Fur Bearers by S. Stanley Hawbaker and sat in the floor studying it, but Hawbaker was from Pennsylvania and he didn't have all that much to say about wolves. When he ran the traps the next day, they were dug out as before. He left the next morning on the road to Animas, and he was on the road 7 hours getting there. He nooned at a spring in a glade of huge old cottonwoods, and ate cold steak and biscuits, and made a paper boat of the bag his lunch had come in, and left it turning and darkening and sinking in the clear still of the spring. The house was on the plain south of the town, and no road to it. There had been a track at one time, and you could see where it ran like the trace of an old wagon road, and that was where he rode till he came to the corner post of the fence. He tied the horse and walked up to the door and knocked, and stood looking out over the plains toward the mountains to the west. Four horses were walking along the final rise out there, and they stopped and turned and looked his way, as if they'd heard his rapping at the door 2 miles distant. He turned to rap again, but as he did, the door opened, and a woman stood looking at him. She was eating an apple, but she didn't speak. He took off his hat. Buenas tardes, he said. El señor está? She bit crisply into the apple with her big white teeth. She looked at him.
El señor, she said.
Don Arnulfo. She looked past him toward the horse tied to the fence post, and she looked at him again. She chewed. She watched him with her black eyes.
El está, he said. I'm thinking it over.
What's there to think about? He's either here or he ain't.
Maybe.
I ain't got no money. She bit into the apple again. It made a loud cracking noise.
He don't want your money, she said.
He stood holding his hat in his hands. He looked out to where he'd seen the horses, but they had disappeared over the rise.
All right, she said.
He looked at her.
He's been sick. Maybe he won't say nothing to you.
Well, he will or he won't.
Maybe you like to come back some other time.
I ain't got some other time. She shrugged.
Bueno, she said. Pásale.
She held open the door and he stepped past into the low mud house.
Gracias, he said.
She gestured with her chin.
Atrás, she said.
Gracias. The old man was in a dark cell of a room at the back of the house. The room smelled of wood smoke and kerosene and sour bedding. The boy stood in the doorway and tried to make him out. He turned and looked back, but the woman had gone on to the kitchen. He stepped down into the room. There was an iron bedstead in the corner, a figure small and dark prone upon it. The room smelled as well of dust or clay, as if it might be that which the old man smelled of. But then even the floor of the room was mud. He said the old man's name, and the old man shifted in his bed.
Adelante, he wheezed.
He stepped forward, still holding his hat. He passed like an apparition through a banded rhomboid of light from the small window in the western wall. The routed dust motes reeled. It was cold in the room, and he could see the pale wisps of the old man's breath rise and vanish in the cold. He could see the black eyes in a weathered face where the old man lay on the bare ticking of his pillow.
Güero, he said. ¿Habla español?
Sí, señor.
The old man's hand rose slightly on the bed and fell again.
Tell me what you want, he said.
I come to ask you about trapping wolves.
Wolves?
Yes, sir.
Wolves, the old man said. Help me.
Sir?
Help me.
He was holding up one hand. It hung trembling in the partial light, disembodied, a hand common to all or none. The boy reached and took it. It was cold and hard and bloodless, a thing of leather and bone. The old man struggled up.
La almohada, he wheezed.
The boy almost put his hat on the bed, but he caught himself. The old man's grip suddenly tightened and the black eyes hardened, but he said nothing. The boy put the hat on and reached behind the old man and got hold of the limp and greasy pillow and stood it against the iron bars of the bedstead, and the old man clutched his other hand as well and then leaned back fearfully until he came to rest against the pillow. He looked up at the boy. He'd a strong grip for all his frailty, and he seemed loath to release the boy's hands until he'd searched out his eyes.
Gracias, he wheezed.
Por nada.
Bueno,
the old man said.
Bueno.
He slacked his grip, and Billy freed one hand and took off his hat again and held it by the brim.
Siéntate,
the old man said. He sat gingerly on the edge of the thin pad that covered the springs of the bed. The old man did not turn loose his hand.
What is your name?
Parham, Billy Parham.
The old man said the name in silence to himself.
¿Te conozco?
No, señor. Estamos a las charcas.
La charca?
Sí.
Hay una historia a la...
¿Historia?
Sí,
said the old man. He lay holding the boy's hand and staring up at the kindling wood latillas of the ceiling.
Una historia desgraciada, de obras desalmadas.
The boy said that he did not know this history and that he would like to hear it, but the old man said that it was as well he did not, for out of some certain things no good could come, and he thought this was one of them. His raspy breath had faded, and the sound of it had faded, and the faint whiteness of it also that had been briefly visible in the cold of the room. His grip on the boy's hand remained as before.
Mr. Sanders said you might have some scent I could buy off of you. He said I ought to ask.
The old man didn't answer.
He give me some that Mr. Eccles had, but the wolves took to digging out the traps and springing them.
¿Dónde está el señor Eccles?
No sé. Se fue.
¿El murió?
No, sir. Not that I've heard.
The old man closed his eyes and opened them again. He lay against the ticking of the pillow with his neck slightly awry. He looked as if he'd been thrown there. In the failing light, the eyes betrayed nothing. He seemed to be studying the shadows in the room.
Conocemos por lo largo de las sombras que tardío es el día, he said.
He said that men took this to mean that the omens of such an hour were thereby greatly exaggerated, but that this was in no way so.
I got one bottle that says No. 7 Matrix, the boy said, and another that don't say nothing.
La Matriz, the old man said.
He waited for the old man to continue, but the old man did not continue. After a while, he asked him what was in the Matrix, but the old man only pursed his thin mouth in doubt. He continued to hold the boy's hand, and they sat that way for some time. The boy was about to put some further query to the old man when the old man spoke again. He said that the Matrix was not so easily defined. Each hunter must have his own formula. He said that things were rightly named its attributes, which could in no way be counted back into its substance. He said that in his opinion only she-wolves in their season were a proper source. The boy said that the wolf of which he spoke was in fact herself a she-wolf, and he asked if that fact should figure in his strategies against her, but the old man only said that there were no more wolves.
El vino de México, the boy said.
He seemed not to hear. He said that Eccles had caught all the wolves.
El señor Sanders me dice que el señor Eccles es medio lobo el mismo. Me dice que él conoce lo que sabe el lobo antes de que lo sepa el lobo.
But the old man said that no man knew what the wolf knew. The sun was low in the west, and the shape of the light from the window lay suspended across the room wall to wall, as if something electric had been cored out of that space. Finally, the old man repeated his words.
El lobo es una cosa incognoscible, he said. Lo que se tiene en la trampa no es más que dientes y foro. El lobo propio no se puede conocer. Lobo o lo que sabe el lobo. Tan como preguntar lo que saben las piedras, los árboles, el mundo.
His breath had gone wheezy from his exertions. He coughed quietly and lay still. After a while he spoke again.
Es cazador el lobo, he said. Cazador. ¿Me entiendes?
The boy didn't know if he understood or not. The old man went on to say that the hunter was a different thing than men supposed. He said that men believe the blood of the slain to be of no consequence, but that the wolf knows better. He said that the wolf is a being of great order, and that it knows what men do not, that there is no order in the world save that which death has put there. Finally, he said that if men drink the blood of God, yet they do not understand the seriousness of what they do. He said that men wish to be serious, but they do not understand how to be so. Between their acts and their ceremonies lies the world, and in this world the storms blow and the trees twist in the wind, and all the animals that God has made go to and fro, yet this world men do not see. They see the acts of their own hands, or they see that which they name and call out to one another, but the world between is invisible to them.
You want to catch this wolf, the old man said. Maybe you want this skin so you can get some money. Maybe you can buy some boots or something like that. You can do that. But where is the wolf? The wolf is like the copo de nieve.
Snowflake.
Snowflake. You catch the snowflake, but when you look in your hand, you don't have it no more. Maybe you see this dechado, but before you can see it, it is gone. If you want to see it, you have to see it on its own ground. If you catch it, you lose it. And where it goes, there is no coming back from. Not even God can bring it back.
The boy looked down at the thin and ropey claws that held his hand. The light from the high window had paled. The sun had set.
Escúchame, joven, the old man wheezed. If you could breathe a breath so strong, you could blow out the wolf, like you blow out the copo, like you blow out the fire from the candela. The wolf is made the way the world is made. You cannot touch the world. You cannot hold it in your hand, for it is made of breath only.
He had pulled himself slightly erect in order to utter these proclamations, and now he subsided against the ticking, and his eyes seemed to study only the roof poles overhead. He eased his thin, cold grip.
"Where is the sun?" he said.
"Se fue."
"Ay. Ándale, joven. Ándale, pues."
The boy withdrew his hand, and he rose. He put on his hat and touched the brim.
"Vaya con Dios."
"Y tú, joven."
Yet before he reached the door, the old man called to him again. He turned and stood.
"¿Cuántos años tienes?" the old man said.
16.
The old man lay quietly in the dark. The boy waited.
"Escúchame, joven," he said. "Yo no sé nada. Esto es la verdad."
"Está bien."
"The Matrice will not help you," the old man said.
He said that the boy should find that place where acts of God and those of man are of a piece, where they cannot be distinguished.
"¿Y qué clase de lugar es este?" the boy said.
"Lugares donde el fierro ya está en la tierra," the old man said. "Lugares donde ha quemado el fuego."
"¿Y cómo se encuentra?"
The old man said that it was not a question of finding such a place, but rather of knowing it when it presented itself. He said that it was at such places that God sits and conspires in the destruction of that which he has been at such pains to create.
"Y por eso soy hereje," he said. "Por eso y nada más."
It was dark in the room. He thanked the old man again, but the old man did not answer, or if he did, he didn't hear him. He turned and went out. The woman was leaning against the kitchen door. She was silhouetted against the yellow light, and he could see her figure through the thin dress she wore. She did not seem troubled that the old man lay alone in the dark at the rear of the house. She asked the boy if the old man had told him how to catch the wolf, and he said that he had not. She touched her temple.
"He don't remember so good sometimes," she said. "He is old."
"Yes, ma'am."
"No one comes to see him."
"That's too bad, hey?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"Not even the priest. He came one time, maybe two, but he don't come no more."
"How come?"
She shrugged.
"People say he is brujo. You know what is brujo?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"They say he is brujo. They say God has abandoned this man. He has the sin of Satanás, the sin of orgullo. You know what is orgullo?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"He thinks he knows better than the priest. He thinks he knows better than God."
"He told me he didn't know nothing."
"Ha," she said. "Ha! You believe that? You see this old man? You know what a terrible thing it is to die without God, to be the one that God has cast aside? Think it over."
"Yes, ma'am. I got to go."
He touched the brim of his hat and stepped past her to the door and walked out into the evening dark. The lights of the town strewn across the prairie lay in that blue veil like a jeweled serpent incandescing in the evening cool. When he looked back at the house, she was standing in the doorway.
"Thank you, ma'am," he said. "He is nothing to me," she called. "No hay parentesco. You know what is parentesco?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"There is no parentesco. He was tío of the dead wife of my dead husband. What is that? You see? And yet I have him here. Who else would take this man? You see? No one cares."
"Yes, ma'am."
"Think it over."
He unlooped the bridle reins from the post and untied them.
"All right," he said, "I will." "It could happen to you."
"Yes, ma'am."
He mounted up and turned the horse and raised one hand. The mountains to the south stood blackly against a violet sky, the snow on the north slopes so pale, like spaces left for messages.
"La fe," she called. "La fe es todo.
He turned the horse out along the rutted track and rode on. When he looked back, she was still standing in the open door, standing in the cold. He looked back one last time, and the door was still open, but she was not there, and he thought perhaps the old man had called her. But then he thought probably that the old man didn't call anybody. 2 days later, riding down the Cloverdale Road, he turned off for no reason at all and rode out to where the vaqueros had nooned and sat his horse looking down at the dead black fire. Something had been digging in the ashes. He dismounted and got a stick and poked through the fire. He mounted up again and walked the horse about the perimeter of the encampment. There was no reason to think that the scavenger had been anything other than a coyote, but he rode anyway. He rode slowly and turned the horse nicely, like a show rider at a judging. On his second circling a little farther from the fire, he stopped. In the wind shadow of a rock where the sand had drifted lay the perfect print of her forefoot. He dismounted and knelt, holding the reins behind his back, and he blew at the loose dirt in the track and pushed at the delicate edges of the track with his thumb. Then he mounted up and went back out to the road and home. The following day, when he ran the traps that he'd reset with the new scent, they were pulled out and sprung as before. He set them again and made 2 blind sets, but his heart was not in it. When he rode down through the pass at noon and looked out over the Cloverdale Valley, the first thing he saw was the thin spire of smoke in the distance from the vaquero's cook fire. He sat the horse a long time. He put his hand on the cantle and looked back toward the pass, and he looked out over the valley again. Then he turned and rode back up the mountain. By the time he'd pulled the traps and packed them in the basket and ridden down into the valley and crossed the road, it was early evening. Once more he checked the sun by the width of his hand on the horizon. He had little more than an hour of daylight. He dismounted at the fire and took the trowel from the pack basket and squatted and began to clear a space among the ashes and charcoal and fresh bones. At the heart of the fire there were live coals yet, and he raked them aside to cool and dug a hole in the ground beneath the fire, and then got a trap from the basket. He didn't even bother to put on the deerskin gloves. He screwed down the springs with the clamps and opened the jaws and set the trigger in the notch and eyed the clearance while he backed off the clamp screw. Then he removed both clamps and dropped the drag hook and chain into the hole and set the trap in the fire. He placed one of the squares of oiled paper over the jaws, that no coals lodge under the pan to keep it from tripping, and he drifted ash over the trap with the screen box and scattered back the charcoal and the charred bits of wood, and he put back the bones and rinds of blackened skin and drifted more ashes over the set, and then rose and stepped away and stood looking at the cold fire and wiping the trowel on the side of his jeans. Lastly, he smoothed a place in the sand before the fire, digging out small clumps of grass and buckbrush, and there he wrote a letter to the vaqueros, etching it deep that the wind not take it. "Cuidado," he wrote. "Hay una trampa de lobos enterrada en el fuego." Then he flung away the stick and dropped the trowel back into the basket and shouldered the basket and mounted up. He rode out across the pasture toward the road, and in the cold blue twilight he turned and looked a last time toward the set. He leaned and spat. "You read my sign," he said, "if you can." Then he turned the horse toward home. It was 2 hours past dark when he walked into the kitchen. His mother was at the stove. His father was still sitting at the table drinking coffee. The worn blue ledger book in which they kept accounts lay on the table to one side. "Where you been?" his father said. He sat down and his father heard him out, and when he was done, he nodded. "All my life," he said, "I've been witness to people showing up where they were supposed to be at various times after they'd said they'd be there. I never heard one yet that didn't have a reason for it." "Yes, sir." "But there ain't but one reason." "Yes, sir." "You know what it is?" "No, sir." "It's that their word's no good. That's the only reason there ever was or ever will be." "Yes, sir." His mother had got his supper from the warmer over the stove, and she set it down in front of him and laid down the silver. "Eat your supper," she said. She left the room. His father sat watching him eat. After a while, he rose and took his cup to the sink and rinsed it out and set it upside down on the sideboard. "I'll call you in the morning," he said. "You need to get over there before you catch you one of them Mexicans."
Yes, sir.
We never would hear the end of it.
Yes, sir.
Ain't no guarantee that a one of 'em can read.
Yes, sir.
He finished his supper and went to bed. Boyd was already asleep. He lay awake a long time, thinking about the wolf. He tried to see the world the wolf saw. He tried to think about it running in the mountains at night. He wondered if the wolf were so unknowable as the old man said. He wondered at the world it smelled or what it tasted. He wondered had the living blood with which it slaked its throat a different taste to the thick iron tincture of his own, or to the blood of God. In the morning he was out before daylight saddling the horse in the cold dark of the barn. He rode out the gate before his father was even up, and he never saw him again. Riding along the road south, he could smell the cattle out in the fields in the dark beyond the bar ditch and the running fence. When he rode through Cloverdale, it was just gray light. He turned up the Cloverdale Creek Road and rode on. Behind him, the sun was rising in the San Luis Pass, and his new shadow riding before him lay long and thin upon the road. He rode past the old dance platform in the woods, and 2 hours later, when he left the road and crossed the pasture to the vaquero's noon fire, the wolf stood up to meet him. The horse stopped and backed and stamped. He held the animal and patted it and spoke to it and watched the wolf. His heart was slamming inside his chest like something that wanted out. She was caught by the right forefoot. The drag had caught in a choya less than 100 feet from the fire, and there she stood. He patted the horse and spoke to it, and reached down and unfastened the buckle on the saddle scabbard and slid the rifle free and stepped down and dropped the reins. The wolf crouched slightly, as if she'd try to hide. Then she stood again and looked at him and looked off toward the mountains. When he approached, she bared her teeth, but she did not growl, and she kept her yellow eyes from off his person. White bone showed in the bloody wound between the jaws of the trap. He could see her teats through the thin fur of her underbelly, and she kept her tail tucked and pulled at the trap and stood. He walked around her. She turned and backed. The sun was well up, and in the sun her fur was a grayish dun with paler tips at the ruff and a black stripe along the back. And she turned and back to the length of the chain, and her flanks sucked in and out with the motion of her breathing. He squatted on the ground and stood the rifle before him and held it by the forestock, and he squatted there for a long time. He was in no way prepared for what he beheld. Among other things, he'd not considered simply whether he could ride to the ranch and be back with his father before the vaqueros arrived at noon, if they would so arrive. He tried to remember what his father had said. If her leg were broke or if she were caught by the paw. He looked at the height of the sun and he looked back out toward the road. When he looked at the wolf again, she was lying down, but when his eyes fell upon her, she stood again. The standing horse tossed its head and the bridle bit clinked, but she paid no attention to the horse at all. He rose and walked back and scabbarded the rifle and took up the reins and mounted up and turned the horse and headed out to the road. Halfway, he stopped again and turned and looked back. The wolf was watching him as before. He sat the horse a long time, the sun warm on his back, the world waiting. Then he rode back to the wolf. She rose and stood with her sides caving in and out. She carried her head low and her tongue hung trembling between the long incisors of her lower jaw. He undid the string from his catch rope and slung it over his shoulder and stepped down. He took some lengths of piggin string from the mochila behind the saddle and looped them through his belt and unlimbered the catch rope and walked around the wolf. The horse was no use to him because if it leaned back on the rope it would kill the wolf or pull it from the trap or both. He circled the wolf and looked for something to tie to that he could stretch her. There was nothing that his rope would reach and double, and finally he took off his coat and blindfolded the horse with it and led it forward upwind of the wolf and dropped the reins that it would stand. Then he paid out the rope and built his loop and dropped it over her. She stepped through it with the trap and looked at it and looked at him. Now he had the rope over the trap chain. He looked at it in disgust and dropped the rope and walked out in the desert until he found a palo verde, and he cut from it a pole some 7 feet long with a forked branch at the end and came back trimming off the limbs with his knife. She watched him. He snared the loop with the end of the pole and pulled it toward him. He thought she might bite at the pole, but she did not. When he got the loop in his hand, he had to pay the whole 40 feet of rope back through the Honda and begin again. She watched the rope make its traverse with great attention, and when the end of it had passed over the trap chain and withdrew through the dead grass, she lay down again. He built a smaller loop and came forward. She stood. He swung the loop, and she flattened her ears and ducked and bared her teeth at him. He made two more tries, and on the third, the loop dropped over her neck, and he snatched the rope taut. She stood twisting on her hind legs, holding the heavy trap up at her chest and snapping at the rope and pawing with her free foot. She let out a low whine, which was the first sound she had made. He stepped back and stretched her out till she lay gasping on the ground, and he backed toward the horse, paying out rope, and then looped the rope about the saddle horn and came back carrying the free end. He winced to see her bloodied forelegs stretched in the trap, but there was no help for it. She got her hindquarters up off the ground and scrabbled sideways, and she twisted and fought the rope and slung her head from side to side, and even once got completely to her feet again before he pulled her down. He squatted, holding the rope just a few feet from her, and after a while she lay gasping quietly in the dirt. She looked toward him with her yellow eyes and closed them slowly and then looked away. He stood on the rope with one foot and took out his knife again and reached carefully and got hold of the Palo Verde pole. He cut a 3-foot length from the end of it and put the knife back in his pocket and took a length of the piggin string from his belt and made a noose with it and took it in his teeth. Then he stepped off the rope and picked up the end of it and moved toward her with the stick. She watched with one almond eye, deep yellow, deepening to amber at the iris. She strained at the rope, her face in the dirt, her mouth open and her teeth so white, so perfectly made. He pulled the rope tighter where it was belayed around the saddle horn. He pulled until he'd shut off her air, and then he jammed the stick between her teeth. She made no sound. She bowed up and twisted her head and bit at the stick and tried to get quit of it. He hauled on the rope and stretched her out, wild and gagging, and forced her lower jaw to the ground with the stick and stepped on the rope again with his boot not a foot from those teeth. Then he took the piggin string from his mouth and dropped the loop of it over her muzzle and jerked it tight, and seized her by one ear and made 3 turns of the cord about her jaws faster than I could follow, and half-hitched it and fell upon her, kneeling with the living wolf gasping between his legs and sucking air and her tongue working within the teeth all stuck with dirt and debris. She looked up at him, the eye delicately aslant, the knowledge of the world it held sufficient to the day, if not to the day's evil. Then she closed her eyes, and he slacked the rope and stood and stepped away, and she lay breathing heavily with her forefoot stretched behind her in the trap and the stick in her mouth. He stood gasping himself. Cold as it was, he was wringing wet with sweat. He turned and looked at the horse, where it stood with his coat over its head. "By damn," he said. "By damn." He coiled the loose rope from off the ground and walked back to the horse and lifted the rope up and over the saddle horn and untied the coat sleeves from under the horse's jaw and unhooded it and laid the coat across the saddle. The horse lifted its head and blew and looked toward the wolf, and he patted it on the neck and spoke to it and got the clamps out of the mochila and pulled the coil of rope up over his shoulder and turned back to the wolf. Before he could reach her, she leapt up and lunged against the trap chain, twisting and slinging her head and pawing at her mouth with her free foot. He pulled her down with the rope and held her. A white foam seethed between her teeth. He approached slowly and reached and held her by the stick in her jaws and spoke to her, but his voice seemed only to make her shudder. He looked at the leg in the trap. It looked bad. He got hold of the trap and put the clamp over the spring and screwed it down and then did the second spring. When the eye of the spring dropped past the hinges in the plate, the jaws fell open and her wrecked forefoot spilled out limp and bloody with the white bone shining. He reached to touch it, but she snatched it away and stood. He was amazed at her quickness. She stood squared off at him, her eyes level with his where he knelt, still not meeting his gaze. He slid the coil of rope off his shoulder to the ground and picked up the end of it and wrapped it around his fist in a double grip. Then he let go slack the short end of the rope by which he held her. She tested the injured foot on the ground and drew it up again. "Go on," he said, "if you think you can." She turned and wheeled away, so quick. He hardly had time to get one heel in front of him in the dirt before she hit the end of the rope. She did a cartwheel and landed on her back and jerked him forward onto his elbows. He scrambled up, but she was already off in another direction, and when she hit the end of the rope again, she almost snatched him off the ground. He turned and dug both heels in and took a turn of the rope around his wrist. She had swung toward the horse now, and the horse snorted and set off toward the road at a trot with the reins trailing. She ran at the end of the rope in a circle until she passed the choya that had first caught the trap chain drag, and here the rope brought her around until she stood snubbed and gasping among the thorns. He rose and walked up to her. She squatted and flattened her ears. Slobber swung in white strings from her jaw. He took out his knife and reached and got hold of the stick in her mouth, and he spoke to her and stroked her head, but she only winced and shivered. "It ain't no use to fight it," he told her. He cut the trailing length of the palo verde off short at the side of her mouth and put the knife away and walked the end of the rope around the choya till it was free, and then led her twisting and shaking her head out onto the open ground. He could not believe how strong she was. He stood spraddle-legged with the rope in both hands across his thighs and turned and scanned the country for some sight of his horse. She would not quit struggling, and he got hold of the rope end again and sat with it doubled in his fist and dug both heels in and let her go. When she hit the end of the rope this time, she flew into the air and landed on her back and lay there. He hauled on the rope and dragged her towards him through the dirt. "Get up," he said. "You ain't hurt." He walked down and stood over her where she lay panting. He looked at the injured leg. There was a flap of loose skin pushed down around her ankle like a sock, and the wound was dirty and stuck with twigs and leaves. He knelt and touched her. "Come on," he said. "You've done run my horse off, so let's go find him." By the time he dragged her out to the road, he was all but exhausted. The horse was standing 100 yards away, grazing in the bar ditch. It raised its head and looked at him and bent to graze again. He half-hitched the catch rope to a fence post and took the last length of cord from his belt and tied the Honda to the rope that the noose could not back off loose. And then he rose and walked back across the pasture to pick his coat up off the ground and to get the trap. When he got back, she was snubbed up against the fence post and half-strangling where she'd gone back and forth. He dropped the trap and knelt and unhitched the rope from the post and paid the whole length of it back and forth through the wires until he had her free again. She got up and sat in the dusty grass and looked off wildly up the road toward the mountains with the foam seething between her teeth and dripping from the palo verde stick. "You ain't got no damn sense," he told her. He rose and put on his coat and jammed the clamps into his coat pocket and slung the trap over his shoulder by the chain, and then dragged her out into the middle of the road and set off with her behind him, sliding stiff-legged and raking a trail through the dust and gravel. The horse raised its head to study them, chewing ruminatively. Then it turned and set off down the road. He stopped and stood looking after it. He turned and looked back at the wolf. In the distance, he could hear the chug of the old rancher's Model A, and he realized that she had heard it some time ago. He shortened up the rope a couple of reaches and dragged the wolf through the bar ditch and stood by the fence, and watched the truck come over the hill and approach in its attendant dust and clatter. The old man slowed and leaned and peered. The wolf was jerking and twisting, and the boy stood behind her and held her with both hands. By the time the truck had pulled abreast of them, he was lying on the ground with his legs scissored about her midriff and his arms around her neck. The old man stopped and sat the idling truck and leaned across and rolled down the window. "What in the hell?" he said. "What in the hell?" "You reckon you could turn that thing off?" the boy said. "That's a damn wolf." "Yes, sir, it is." "What in the hell?" "The truck's scaring her." "Scaring her?" "Yes, sir." "Boy, what's wrong with you? That thing comes out of that rigging, it'll eat you alive." "Yes, sir." "What are you doing with him?" "It's a she." "It's a what?" "A she, it's a she." "Hell fire, don't make a damn he or she. What are you doing with it?"
"Fixing to take it home."
"Home?"
"Yes, sir."
"Whatever in the contumacious hell for?"
"Can you not turn that thing off?"
"It ain't all that easy to start again."
"Well, could I maybe get you to drive down there and catch my horse for me and bring him back? I'd tie her up, but she gets all fuzzled up in the fence wire."
"What I'd like to do is to try and save you the trouble of being it," the old man said. "What are you taking it home for?"
"It's kindly a long story."
"Well, I'd sure like to hear it." The boy looked down the road where the horse stood grazing. He looked at the old man.
Well, he said, my daddy wanted me to come and get him if I caught her, but I didn't want to leave her because they's been some vaqueros taking their dinner over yonder, and I figured they'd probably shoot her, so I just decided to take her on home with me.
Have you always been crazy?
I don't know. I never was much put to the test before today.
How old are you?
16.
16?
Yes, sir.
Well, you ain't got the sense God give a goose. Did you know that?
You may be right.
How do you expect your horse to tolerate a bunch of nonsense such as this?
If I can get him caught, he won't have a whole lot to say about it.
You plan on leading that thing behind a horse?
Yes, sir.
How you expect to get her to do that?
She ain't got a whole lot of choice either.
The old man sat looking at him. Then he climbed out of the truck and shut the door and adjusted his hat and walked around and stood at the edge of the bar ditch. He had on canvas pants and a blanket-lined canvas coat with a corduroy collar, and he wore boots with walking heels and a full beaver John B. Stetson hat.
How close can I get? He said.
Close as you want.
He crossed the ditch and came up and stood looking at the wolf. He looked at the boy and he looked at the wolf some more.
She's fixing to have pups.
Yes, sir.
Damn good thing you caught her.
Yes, sir.
Can you touch her?
Yes, sir, you can touch her.
The old man squatted and put his hand on the wolf. The wolf bowed and writhed, and he snatched his hand away. Then he touched her again. He looked at the boy.
Wolf,
he said.
Yes, sir.
What do you aim to do with her?
I don't know.
I guess you'll collect the bounty, sell the hide.
Yes, sir.
She don't much like being touched, does she?
No, sir, not much.
When we used to bring cattle up the valley from down around Cienega Springs, why, first night we'd generally hit in about government draw and make camp there. And you could hear 'em all across the valley. Them first warm nights, you'd nearly always hear 'em in that part of the valley. I ain't heard one in years.
She come up from Mexico.
I don't doubt it. Every other damn thing does.
He rose and looked off down the road to where the horse was grazing.
You want my advice, he said. You let me fetch you that rifle I see sticking out of the boot yonder and shoot this son of a bitch right between the eyes and be done with it.
If I can just get my horse caught, I'll be all right, the boy said.
Well, you suit yourself.
Yes, sir, I aim to.
The old man shook his head.
All right, he said. Wait here and I'll go get him.
I ain't going nowheres, the boy said.
He went back to the truck and got in and drove down to where the horse was standing. When the horse saw the truck coming, it crossed through the bar ditch and stood against the fence. And the old man got out and walked the horse down along the fence until he could catch the trailing reins. And then he led the horse back up the road. The boy sat holding the wolf. It was very quiet. The only sound along the road was the faint dry clop of the horse's hooves in the gravel and the steady chugging of the truck where the old man had left it idling by the roadside. When he dragged the wolf out to the road, the horse backed and stood facing her.
Maybe you better tie the horse, the old man said.
If you'll just hold him a minute, I'll be all right.
I ain't sure but what I'd about as soon hold the wolf.
The boy paid out enough slack so that the wolf could get to the bar ditch, but not enough for her to reach the fence. He dallied the rope to the saddle horn and turned the wolf loose, and she scampered for the ditch on three legs and hit the rope end and flipped endwise and got up and crouched in the ditch and lay waiting. The boy turned and took the reins from the old man and put one knuckle to his hat brim.
"I'm much obliged," he said.
"That's all right. It's been an interesting day."
"Yes, sir. Mine ain't over."
"No, it ain't. You mind she don't get that mouth loose, you hear? She'll take a chunk out of you you couldn't put in your hat."
"Yes, sir."
He stood in the stirrup and swung up and checked the dally and nudged his hat back and nodded to the old man.
"I'm much obliged," he said.
When he put the horse forward, the wolf came up out of the ditch at the end of the rope with the game foot to her chest and swung into the road and went dragging after the horse, stiff-legged and rigid as a piece of taxidermy. He stopped and looked back. The old man was standing in the road watching them.
"Sir," he said.
"Yes?"
"Maybe you better go on by and get your truck, so you won't have to pass us." I think that's a good idea.
He walked down and got into the truck and turned and looked back at them. The boy raised his hand. The old man looked like he might be going to call something to him, but he didn't, and he lifted his hand and turned and pulled away down the road toward Cloverdale. He went on. Gusts of wind were blowing dust off the top of the road. When he looked back at her, she had her windward eye asquint against the blowing grit, and she was hobbling along after the horse with her head lowered. He stopped, and she came slightly forward to slack the rope, and then turned and went down into the bar ditch again. He was about to put the horse forward when she squatted in the ditch and began to make water. When she was done, she turned and sniffed at the spot and checked the wind with her nose, and then came up into the road and stood with her tail between her hocks and the wind, making little furrows in her hair. The boy sat the horse a long time, watching her. Then he got down and dropped the reins and got his canteen and walked around to where she was standing. She backed along the reach of the rope. He slung the canteen over his shoulder and stepped over the rope and held it between his knee and pulled her to him. She twisted and stood, but he got hold of the noose and doubled it in his fist and forced her down into the grass by the side of the road and got a straddle of her. It was all he could do to hold her. He slung the canteen around and unscrewed the cap with his teeth. The horse stamped in the road, and he spoke to it, and then holding the wolf by the stick in her mouth with her head against his knee, he began slowly to pour water into the side of her mouth. She lay still. Her eye stopped moving. Then she began to swallow. Most of the water ran out on the ground, but he continued to trickle it between her teeth along the green stick bit. When the canteen was empty, he let go of the stick, and she lay quietly getting her breath. He stood and stepped back, but she didn't move. He swung the cap up by its chain and screwed it back onto the canteen and walked back out to the horse and slung the canteen over the mochila and looked back at her. She was standing watching him. He mounted up and nudged the horse forward. When he looked back, she was limping along at the end of the rope. When he stopped, she stopped. An hour down the road, he stopped for a long time. He was at Robertson's cross fence. Ahead, an hour's ride, lay Cloverdale and the road north. South lay the open country. The yellow grass healed under the blowing wind, and sunlight was running over the country before the moving clouds. The horse shook its head and stamped and stood. "Damn all of it," the boy said. "Just damn all of it." He turned the horse and crossed through the ditch and rode up onto the broad plain that stretched away before him, south, toward the mountains of Mexico. Midday, they crossed through a low pass in the easternmost spur of the Guadalupes and rode out down the open valley. They saw riders on the plain in the distance, but the riders rode on. Late afternoon, they passed through the last low cones of hills on that volcanic ground, and an hour later they came to the last fence in the country. It was a cross fence running east and west. On the other side was a dirt track. He turned the horse east and followed the fence. There was a cattle trail along the fence, but he rode a rope length from it that the wolf not cross under the wires, and by he came to a ranch house. He sat the horse on a slight rise of ground and studied the house. He could see no safe place to leave the wolf, so he continued on. At the gate he dismounted and unpinned the chain and swung the gate open and led the horse and wolf through and closed the gate again and remounted. The wolf was standing bowed up in the road with its hair all wrong, like something pulled backwards out of a pipe, and when he put the horse forward, she came skidding behind with her legs locked. He looked back at her. "If I'd been eating these people's cows," he said, "I wouldn't want to come calling neither." Before he could put the horse forward again, there was a great howl from the direction of the house, and when he looked, three large hounds were coming up the road very low and very fast. "Shit almighty," he said. He stepped down and snubbed the reins to the top fence wire and snatched the rifle out of the scabbard. Bird's eyes were rolling, and he began to stamp about in the road. The wolf stood stock still with her tail up and her hair straight out. The horse turned and backed at the reins. The fence wire bowed. He heard in the melee a staple pop, and he suddenly saw, as in an evil dream, the specter of the horse at full gallop on the plain with the wolf behind at the end of the rope and the dogs in wild pursuit. And he snatched the rope from about the saddle horn just as the reins broke, and the horse wheeled and went pounding, and he turned with the rifle and the wolf to stand off the dogs suddenly all about him in a bedlam of howling and teeth and whited eyes. They circled, scrabbling in the dirt of the road, and he pulled the wolf hard up against his leg and yelled at them and whacked them away with the barrel of the rifle. Two were carrying broken lengths of chain at their collar, and the third wore no collar at all. In all that whirling pandemonium, he could feel the wolf trembling electrically against him and her heart hammering. They were working hounds, and although they circled and bayed, he knew that they would be loath to attack anything a man held in absolute custody, even if it was a wolf. He turned with them and caught one of them in the side of the head with the barrel of the rifle. "Git!" he shouted. "Git!" By now, two men were coming from the house at a trot. They called the dogs by name, and two of the dogs actually stopped and looked back down the road. The third arched its back and came at the wolf with a mincing sidelong step and popped its teeth at her and drew away again and stood howling. One of the men had a dinner napkin hanging from the neck of his shirt, and he was breathing heavily. "You, Julie!" he called. "Git! Damnation! Get a stick or something, R.L. Good God!" The other man unlatched his buckle and whipped his belt out through the loops and began to lay about him with the buckle end. Instantly, the dogs were yelping and scurrying. The older man stopped and stood with his hands on his hips, catching his breath. He turned to the boy. He saw the napkin in his shirt and pulled it free and wiped his forehead with it and stuck the napkin in his back pocket. "You mind telling me what the hell you're doing?" he said. "Trying to keep these damn dogs off of my wolf." "Don't give me no smart answer." "I ain't. I come up on your fence and went to hunting a gate is all. I didn't know all hell was fixing to bust loose." "What the hell did you expect was going to happen?" "I didn't know there was dogs here." "Well, hell, you seen the house, didn't you?"
"Yes, sir."
The man squinted at him.
"You're Will Parham's boy, ain't you?"
"Yes, sir."
"What's your name?"
"Billy Parham."
"Well, Billy, this might sound to you like an ignorant question, but what in the hell are you doing with that thing?"
"I caught it."
"Well, I reckon you did. It's the one with the stick in its mouth." "Where you started with it?"
"I was started home."
"No, you wasn't. You was headed yon way."
"I was started home with it when I changed my mind."
"What did you change it to?"
The boy didn't answer. The dogs were pacing up and down, the hair standing along their backs.
"R.L., take the dogs onto the house and put them up. Tell Mama I'll be there directly."
He turned to the boy again.
"How do you aim to get your horse back?"
"Walk him down, I reckon."
"Well, it's about 2 miles to the first cattle guard."
The boy stood holding the wolf. He looked off down the road in the direction the horse had gone.
"Will that thing ride in a truck?" the man said.
The boy gave him a peculiar look.
"Hell," the man said, "I want you to listen at me. R.L., can you take him in the truck to catch his horse?"
"Yes, sir. Is his horse hard to catch?"
"Your horse hard to catch?" the man said.
"No, sir."
"He says it ain't."
"Well, unless he just wants to go riding, I reckon I can get his horse for him."
"You don't want to ride with that wolf is what it is," the man said.
"It ain't that I don't want to. It's that I ain't going to."
"Well, I was fixin' to say that since it's liable to jump out of the bed of the truck, why don't you take it up front in the cab with you and the boy can ride in the back?"
R.L. had the dogs by their trailing pieces of chain and was fastening the third dog to them with his belt.
"I got a life-size picture of me riding up the road with a wolf in the cab of my truck," he said. "I can just see it plain as day."
The man stood looking at the wolf. He reached to adjust his hat, but he had no hat on, so he scratched his head. He looked at the boy.
"And here I thought I knowed all the lunatics in this valley," he said. "Country crowding up the way it is. You can't hardly keep up with your own neighbors, even. Have you had your supper?"
"No, sir."
"Well, come on to the house."
"What do you want me to do with her?"
"Her?"
"This here wolf."
"Well, I guess it'll just have to lay around the kitchen till we get done eating."
"Lay around the kitchen?"
"It's a joke, son. Hellfire. You brought that thing in the house, you could hear my wife in Albuquerque with the wires down."